Scott Woods here from Toronto. I'm chatting on the phone with Bob Dobbs in Maui. Bob?
Yes.
Okay, it's November 9th, 2009. I chatted with Bob back in 1999, so almost 10 years ago. I don't know the exact date, but that was for a site called Popped. Bob and I talked about rock history, and Bob put it in his own inimitable Bob sort of language, and I wanted to really chat with Bob again as a follow-up to talk more about rock critics, and obviously this is in part for rockcritics.com. So without any further ado, Bob, let's get right into it. So I sent, just as a way, another way of an introduction, I sent Bob a whole sort of package of articles recently by the likes of Richard Meltzer, Chuck Eddy, Frank Kogan, Lester Bangs, Greil Marcus, a couple other things, and I just wanted to sort of, you know, chat with Bob about those, maybe throw get him to throw some of that stuff back at me and sort of explain it all. So, but Bob, before we go directly into the articles themselves, I just kind of wanted to, you know, start with a few other things. So, just to give some of the rockcritics.com listeners a bit of a background on some of your recent activity, you do a series of, I believe it's weekly chats with the writer Ben Watson, who's the author of Frank Zappa's Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play, and I'll put a link up to those chats. They're really amazing chats, and you and Ben basically talk a lot about, you do talk about Zappa, but that's often kind of seems almost like sideline material, but you tend to talk a lot about James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, McLuhan, Marx, sometimes Freud, you know, whole sort of range of stuff. So one thing you guys have kind of mentioned on a few occasions, and I think this is maybe going to be relevant later on in the interview, so I wanted to sort of bring it up at the start. Can you just give me a really sort of basic kind of explanation of the Joyce, James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, I guess you'd call it the dialectic? Because I think you guys have alluded to the fact that you two have that dialectic going yourself, and I assume, Bob, that you're kind of the James Joyce and Ben is the Wyndham Lewis. But I'm also sort of thinking of it in regards to, like, even Lester Bangs and Richard Meltzer in some ways. And I think you've also related it to Zappa and Beefheart. But I don't know where you're going with that. And I'll tell you off the bat that I know a little bit about James Joyce and very little about Wyndham Lewis. And I'm not asking you to, you know, fill in all the gaps, all the blanks for me on that, but, you know, whatever.
Okay, so the dialectic between Joyce and Lewis is what you want clarified.
Exactly,
like.
Yeah.
Well, they were both born in 1882, and Wyndham Lewis was born in the Bay of Fundy, which is the bay that surrounds Nova Scotia in Canada. And right at the isthmus where the bay, it could be cut off, the Nova Scotia could be an island, but there's a little isthmus joining it with New Brunswick, and there's a place called Amherst there. And that's where Wyndham Lewis was born. He was the son of an American businessman, happy-go-lucky guy, and a British woman. I think that's the way it is. So they split, and Wyndham Lewis grew up in London. And I think she was a pretty culture vulture mother, you know, sophisticated. So he got into art school real early. And he was a genius at painting, which is sort of like Beefheart as a young genius in sculpture. You know what I mean? He was a young prodigy. And Wyndham Lewis, 1916, 1920 pictures, he looks just like Don Van Vliet, which is interesting. So Wyndham Lewis, what else to say? So he was a Canadian, but he had British citizenship also. And so, and when he fought in World War One, he fought as a Canadian, but then he also did stuff painting for the British troops. So he's always in between. Okay, so he's a painter and an intellectual and a thinker. Joyce grows up in Dublin, and he's a singer. He's a musician and a thinker and all that. And so you have, as McLuhan would lay it out, you have the eye man Lewis versus the ear man Joyce. And so Wyndham Lewis created the vortices scene in 1914, and he had his colleagues, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and a few other people, and Lewis was the the Frank Zappa of 1966 bursting on the scene. He was so powerful, you know, everybody learned from him. Because he'd been in Europe in the knots, running around because he left art school, you know, at the age of 18 or so, and done that and was really good at it. And then he ran around, learned what was happening in Europe. So he knew more what was happening in Europe by 1914 than the artists in London. So it's just like Zappa. You look on the cover of Freakout, he's got 179 names, right? For his generation, he was the most well-versed in all kinds of music. You follow that, Scott?
Yeah.
So that's what Wyndham Lewis was. Here's a guy looking like Beefheart, but having the impact of Zappa in 1966, back in 1914. But then when he went to the war, he got shocked and traumatized by the war, and that changed him. Okay, so James Joyce is discovered by Pound, and he's in Switzerland, 1916, and he's writing Ulysses. And he starts reading Wyndham Lewis's Enemy of the Stars, which is published in the big magazine journal that Pound and Lewis put out in 1914 called Blast.
Okay.
And this Enemy of the Stars is prophetic. It's the most, you know, hallucinatory thing. It's theater of the absurd already, and other things. And that influenced Joyce, and he changed his Ulysses and added a little more hallucinatory aspect in the Circe episode, which was near the end of Ulysses. Plus, he was influenced by the Dada scene in Zurich. So Lewis had an influence on Joyce, and they became friends around 1920 when Joyce moved to Paris. So they were buddies, but Joyce's Ulysses in 1922 really put Joyce on the map, and Lewis wasn't getting that much publicity, even though they both put out novels about being an artist in the teens. And so Portrait of the Artist's Young Man, I think, had an impact, but Lewis's book Tarr, T-A-R-R, came out in 1918, 1919, did better for a moment. And so it looked like Lewis was going to be the writer of his generation. But then Joyce one-upped him with Ulysses. And Lewis, very competitive or something, he withdrew and got upset about that. So he was out to nail Joyce in a way, or outdo Joyce. But he understood what Joyce was working on. He had influenced Joyce, and they both studied anthropology and all kinds of things. They were eclectic minds and equal geniuses. And back then, if you're an independent artist, you had to get publicity to survive. You had to make a scene in the newspaper world. So Ulysses made a scene being pornographic or whatever, right? And it was banned. So Lewis, he got attention by being the outsider critic and satirizing even the avant-garde of London, the Bloomsbury Group. So there always was this competition and appreciation, love-hate relationship between Joyce and Lewis, like Beefheart and Zappa. You know,
okay.
Lewis took on. He saw what Joyce did, and I really recommend you read The Art of Being Ruled or Time in Western Man, where it has Wyndham Lewis's essays on Joyce and many other things, and they're really brilliant essays. And he's staking out his position opposite to Joyce. Joyce he sees as an ear man, lost in the flux of time, emotion, and sentiment. Whereas Lewis is the hard-edged, almost scientific, literate, objective guy, which he calls the school of space. And Lewis and Joyce is the space of the devolving school of time, and Lewis is the space of is the school of space or the eye. So it's eye versus the ear, and Joyce knows this, and you can see it all the way through The Wake. There's a whole section where there's a debate between him and Lewis, and he's quoting via puns. You have to know the references to know what's happening in the polyglot language of Finnegan's Wake. If you know the references, you can see that it's eye man Lewis confronting the ear man Joyce. And it's called The Muxie and the Gripes, The Fox and the Grapes, Aesop Fables, what it's based on, and it builds from there. So you have Lewis not being sort of emotional, and Joyce being musical and emotional. This is very crude, simple terms, but back then, that's how people, they would respond instinctively, like, oh, Lewis, this guy, he's like so detached, he's inhuman. And Joyce is like celebrating the voluptuousness of the woman's skirts or something, and like totally stoned almost. It's like Lewis is stoned without taking a drug, and Joyce is stoned while taking the drug, right?
Right, okay.
And so Lewis is, understands Joyce. He's the first to satirize Finnegan's Wake when it was 10 years before it was published. In 1928, he put out a book called The Childer Mass. And,
okay, yeah.
And Joyce is just publishing Finnegan's Wake as work in progress in Transition magazine, you know, a cultural magazine in France, in Paris, and nobody knows what Joyce is doing, but Lewis takes it on and satirizes it right there in Childer Mass in 1928, in the style. He tries to outdo the Finnegan's Wake style. And so there was this interaction. So basically, that would be the simple spy versus spy cartoon outline of Lewis versus Joyce. Once you get into the writing, they're very similar. They're equally these categories fall apart. But the point is, even Joyce knew that these categories worked on the cartoon level, which is a mode in Finnegan's Wake. Now, all this is relevant because when we get into Melton, this stuff, the theme that I'm bringing to it is that Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print. Or rock, or hip-hop, modern electrified music in print. Now, that's an incredible pattern once you get it, and then you can fit all this stuff that Meltzer, Bangs, and them are trying to work out through that filter. So that's why you have Lewis and Joyce paralleling Marx versus McLuhan, Zappa versus Beefheart. And remember, the argument that Lewis purposely made himself opposite of Joyce to get publicity so
right.
he could sell his books. It's all within the PR game or
okay.
sensationalism, which Beefheart and Zappa did. And McLuhan and Marx did. They all played the media.
Okay.
So
McLuhan and Marx weren't together at the same time.
No, but Marx says a meme was around, you know. It's McLuhan
right,
called
right, yeah.
it. It's a genre of literature, Marx's studies.
Okay.
It's a type of literature. But Marx, as a product of the Telegraph era, I mean, the Telegraph has brought together the working class around the world, and he's the Abbey Hoffman of it.
Right, okay. And wasn't McLuhan's criticism of Marx that he didn't perceive the effects of the technology?
Of the communications technology.
Communications technology.
Yeah, see, Marx was good at the hardware environment, the production, means of production, and what that did. But McLuhan would say that Marx missed the effects of the telegraph in allowing Marx to become well-known, and then missing later the effect of radio on Moscow and why you have a different kind of communism in Russia. So Marx, and he didn't understand, I don't think, Ben might find quotes that disagree with this, Ben Watson, but he did not see how software would become the major means of production and wealth generation in the 20th century.
Okay.
Not factory work.
Okay.
So that puts the unions into a weak case, you know, in the long run.
Right. Okay. Okay, a different sort of thought altogether. Bob, see if you can be the first person to say something interesting about this old cliche of a quote that is probably, if you were to Google it, you'd probably find, like, you know, 22,000 examples of it. The quote is this: writing about rock music is like dancing about architecture. Now, the quote, by the way, has been attributed to tons of people, including Frank Zappa, but the earliest person I've actually seen it attributed to is Thelonious Monk. And I don't think anyone knows definitively who said it, although I think lots of people have said it, maybe even thinking that they were the, you know, the person who invented it or something weird. But it's this quote that is kind of everywhere, and I've not really heard anything sort of intelligent or interesting about it. Is there anything intelligent or interesting to say about it?
No, it's a
writing about rock music is like dancing about architecture.
That is a perfect quote to illustrate why Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print. The hidden factor about electrified music is that it's not the ear, and it's not the eye, or the kinetic muscle, it's tactile. And jazz was the first electrified music, okay, played over the radio, and then with the broadcast system and microphones. The electrification of music is not Beethoven, Mozart, and that stuff. when you, and then you, okay, so if tactility is electrified music, the tactile is the interplay of the senses. And so you think of synesthesia. You know what synesthesia is, right?
Explain it.
Synesthesia is where you hear something, but you see the music, or you you smell something, and you can hear a sound from it. Now, you'll get synesthesia if you take, you know, drugs like LSD and maybe marijuana. Your senses start getting scrambled, your sensory inputs, and so they get all mixed up, and that's called synesthesia. All right, so writing about music and dancing about architecture is totally appropriate when you understand the 20th century is largely a tactile synesthetic environment. It actually makes sense. We are writing about music, we are dancing about architecture, because architecture can be expanded. If we move from the ear man, from the eye man who has definite Oxford Dictionary definitions for architecture, all of modern 20th century art is to blur those distinctions that literacy creates and categories that are hardening of the categories. Modern art likes to blur that. And to blur it is to move into the ear side of things. Okay, so so architecture is not just buildings, it is the highways that are built.
Right.
You know, the environments are architecture, so you expand the meaning of architecture. And then you say, what is music? Well, McLuhan said that teenage music, rock and roll in the 50s, 60s, was not music, it was an environment. And that's a correct way to begin to approach rock and roll, because it is electrified and is perceived in all different kinds of acoustic media, radios, transistors, and concert halls, and loud and soft. So, since it's synesthetic, the communication environment, so we're not inside, when we're inside a building and we're listening to radio, we're not limited to the building. We're listening to something that's coming through. We're discarnate. So to actually determine where you are from the eye point of view is limited. To determine where you are from the ear point of view is limited. To determine it through the kinetic expression, like dancing, is limited. You have to realize that writing is music, is dancing, is architecture, is tactile implosion.
Right, okay.
And so when you know the senses and the machines that are extension of senses are imploded, increasingly as the 20th century unfolds, you know that, as McLuhan said, the 20th century is a surrealistic canvas from the get-go.
Right.
So you see, a literate person will say, writing about... Now, okay, so an ear person, ear bias, would say, no, music is an antidote to the stupid literate guys. You know, the scientists, the writers. We loosen you up when you come to our club. You've been reading your newspapers and accounting books all day long. We loosen you up. We get you out of the visual space trance.
Right.
So the musician would say, we don't want to hear about your writing. We're here to cancel the effect of writing, so don't even begin to write about us. Okay, so that's the fanatic of the ear. The fanatic of the eye would say, okay, architecture is a building, and it's a library, and you don't make noise in here, you don't dance in here. Because the eye guy says architecture is limited to what you think a building is, and doesn't notice that the ear qualities, the tactile, kinesthetic, other forms of media sensibility. So both the eye and the ear are biased. So the ear guy says no writing about music, and the eye guy says no dancing about architecture. It's an eye thing. You must know your draftsman ability. You must know how to critique and see the lay of the building and the engineering. That's all eye stuff.
Right.
So the eye guy doesn't tolerate dancing. So what is it? Writing about music is like dancing about architecture. So the eye guy would not appreciate Mercy Cunningham or Martha Graham's interpretation of architecture. It was something like that, right?
Right.
I mean, it's interesting. I can understand a musician saying no writing about music. I mean, a fanatic musician, a cool musician, you know, a comprehensive musician wouldn't be limited to that. They'd enjoy the writing because it's translating your music into another sense, and that's the only way you can know anything, by translating one thing into another modality. Now, who would complain about dancing about architecture? You know, that shifts, the musician might say that, but it sounds like an eye guy would say, that's like dancing about, it's actually mixed up, that metaphor.
It is very mixed up.
Yeah, which is good. That's synesthetic. I mean, I'm assuming that a musician is complaining about writing about music, and he's saying that. So then the musician would say, that's like dancing but architects. But that's absurd for a musician. A musician's all for dancing.
Well, no, it's more common usage, though, is actually by critics or music journalists saying, you know, they're kind of like trying to sort of fess up to the futility of what they're doing. Like, you know, writing about music, oh, how can you write about music? It's like dancing about architecture. How can you do that?
That's where
the ellipses leads to how could you do such a thing?
Yes, and that's why culture, as McLuhan said, culture's our business, and culture's our plantation, and everybody, like Robert Christgau and these guys, are forced to review all these records because they need to survive, and they need to make sure Meltzer doesn't screw up the record industry so they don't get ads for the Village Voice and all that stuff. Everybody working in the culture business is a slave and not very happy, and yet he's forced to write about he's supposed to write about music. So everybody's self-conscious about what they're forced to do, and they'll say things like that, but it doesn't stop anything, and they keep writing about music.
Right, right.
And you build on Finnegan's Wake, and you get a vision, which is what I'm trying to impart to Ben Watson, a vision that makes one more articulate about the drama of what's going on, and you wouldn't be stuck sort of resignedly, cynically saying, write about music, like dancing about architecture. You know, you would celebrate the fact that you're writing about it, or that you're dancing, if you understood the tactile nature of the 20th century. So we're going to go into that when we get into these quotes, but if you want to go to your next point that you have already laid out.
Okay, well, actually, since you mentioned Christgau, and I'm pulling a quote from you in your chat with Ben Watson, and I know I'm pulling this, you know, probably out of context, which maybe is okay, but...
Oh, wait a minute. Before we go on... So what I just, you wanted to have an original response to that. I scored 100% on that, right?
Yeah, exactly. 110.
Yeah, that's an original response to that cliche.
Yeah, well, it's flipping the cliche to, it's like, yeah, well, why wouldn't it be and why wouldn't you celebrate that?
Yeah, and it's also, it's finding it saying more than people who are limited to their eye or ear bias, finding out more what's being said by that phrase.
Sorry, say that again?
Where I'm showing there's more in the statement writing about music like dancing about architecture than an eye-biased or ear-biased person would find.
Right, right.
So I'm not stuck in the cliché. I consider it a relevant statement. It's very useful.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So you said on your Bob and Ben show a few episodes ago, you know, that rock criticism is stupid, and you kind of pointed to the example of someone like Robert Christgau, who, you know, he's basically someone who's been reviewing like 20 records a month for about 40 years now. And, you know, I mean, the one thing you said in your last little thing there was, you know, like, I mean, I wouldn't put Robert Christgau in the camp of people who would be unhappy at all about what they're doing, or would use that quote in some disparaging way or something. I mean, I think Robert Christgau loves what he's doing, actually.
Yeah.
But to tell me, why is rock criticism stupid, and why do you think of an example like someone like a Christgau who for me, that kind of work would be absolutely drudgerous to do that. I wouldn't be hardwired to be able to pull something like that off. So, I don't know, go into that a little bit.
Well, it's, what I say is always dependent on who I'm talking to, and in the Ben context, that's why I said that. But now I'm talking to you, I would say that what I meant that rock writing was stupid was you end up working for the industry and killing your ears and listening to this stuff and having to perform, and I agree with Meltzer, it's a disgusting industry, basically. I get that from Dave Neufeld, too. To be involved with these idiot flacks and records and promos, it's a crummy job. It might be better than working in a factory or being homeless, but I think since it is an extension of the industry, you can't probe it like Meltzer did. He got kicked out, and Meltzer, he didn't know it, but he was on the right track in terms of trying to philosophically explain what his joy was and what he was noticing. So, I would say any long-term job of consumption like that is stupid. So now I wouldn't just limit to rock criticism, but we were talking about it with Ben. So I said, yeah, rock criticism is stupid, and that's why Ben left. He had the same problem. You can't. Now this raises a good question, which is what Finnegan's Wake raises: is, are you dead? Is Robert Crisco, does he have good ears? Does if he's good at assessing an album for the industry and critiquing it, or I don't know what he does with it. I don't read his reviews, but is he really on a drug? You know, is this useful for creating perception? I mean, they're just ramming out music all over the place right now. Do we need to hear it? Definitely young people need to hear it because they're groping through life. They're trying to expand their senses, and they love it. Doesn't matter what it is. They're going to like it, you know? So it's the electrified tactile experience. So to sit in that industry and make judgments about this environment that's a global drug, global heroin, you have to be cynical. You have to say, well, I'll just fight this crap, and I'll keep getting paid, and I don't have to go work for someone else.
Yeah, but I mean, I can't obviously speak for someone like Robert Christgau, but I mean, I think what would drive him to continue doing what he does is he likes doing it. He has a compulsion to like listen to like tons of albums all the time.
Yeah, he's addicted.
And it is true. Apparently, he is he listens to it all the time. But it's, you know, I mean, he's a writer. It's his chosen subject to write about. And he wants to explore it from as many. I mean, I'm sort of taking sides here a little bit because it's like, it's his. It's what he wants to explore. So why wouldn't he want to explore? Like, I just don't think it necessarily has anything to do with the industry per se. I know that's his function that he's doing that, but I don't think he's doing that because, you know.
I'd say he's addicted.
I'm gonna prop up the industry or something like that.
He's got. He's got virtual ears. He's addicted. Now, here's the other part of why rock writing is stupid. I castigate it all from Meltzer to Bangs and Crisco and everybody else because they don't begin to teach people the way a real critical function is supposed to be. They don't teach people and begin with the notion of Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print. They don't tell anybody a way to get a perspective on all this phenomena that everybody's addicted to. And they do not teach properly, is what I'm saying, in their role. And they probably couldn't. And then they would include, remember, James Joyce handed Finnegan's Wake over to another guy to continue writing in the late 20s.
Okay.
All right? It's not a personal role to do Finnegan's Wake. It's a corporate role. These guys have, these critics have a corporate role of enlightening the consumer about what's useful and what isn't. And they don't offer a big picture view of the larger thing because they always think they're working for the revolution or not working for the revolution, and they don't even know what the revolution is. So we're talking about a bunch of kids, guys who maybe Crisco went to Dartmouth and Meltzer went to Yale, but they never got the real important information that was happening in the real rock and roll avant-garde, which was Mr. McLuhan up in Toronto. That's what's interesting, how you notice that Meltzer sounds like McLuhan. And we'll go into that later. And it's very good that you brought that up with him. I didn't know until I just read your interview with him. But the point is that there's no justification for what they're doing other than they're just little nodes, dangling participles, responding to electronic stimulus that is just an endless tidal wave that they're just sending out blips and signals about. You can get a perspective and put this rock and roll experience into a meaningful pattern. And then that might, if you really get my point, you'll be so stoned on this insight that you actually could stop listening to music. Because part of the addiction is they're trying to find out why they're like it. And you can't do it if you just use your eye and your ear. You've got to understand what tactility is and how electric music is tactile. And then you have to see how to look at it. And you look at it through Finnegan's Wake. So we'll develop that more. So there's two ways to say rock writing is stupid. All those guys are stupid, not because they're industry lackeys, is that they never learned the lesson from it or what it meant. Now, it might be amazing just to pronounce that, you know, rock and roll is meaningful in the way I'm intending to, but we'll get to that. I'll prove my point.
Well, but, okay, so I mean, I feel like I've gotten some insights, some genuine insights from these people, and even if you want to look at it on the McLuhan kind of level or whatever, someone like Meltzer certainly sort of intuits some of that, I guess. I guess we will get into that, but
yeah.
I'm having a hard time kind of like I don't know. It's like Finnegan's Wake is kind of.
You don't know what I mean yet.
No, I don't.
Yeah, true. That's okay. I'm just saying what the insight that we're going to get to, if it's
okay.
Possible. So yeah. I want to finish your questions that you have, the preamble questions, we'll call them.
Okay, we're almost done, though. So
okay.
This is kind of a bit of a bizarre tangent, but I'm curious, Bob, why you think there's way more male rock critics than female rock critics?
It's the left hemisphere male forced to adapt to the electric right hemisphere environment and keep his left hemisphere going. So that's the absurdity of rock criticism. It's the left hemisphere trying to make sense out of a right hemisphere experience. So that is writing about music. It looks absurd. It's the left hemisphere trying to explain the right hemisphere. So traditionally, if you believe the right hemisphere, left hemisphere dialectic, and it ran its course through the 80s. People believed it for a while. Now it's debunked. But so what? Every meme has power once it's established. It's still there. So from the perspective of that, left hemisphere is more in the male brain. So it's the left hemisphere trying to explain the right hemisphere environment, and for a literate left hemisphere culture, that's America, and America wants to read about it, so the men would be better at it than women. You know, the need for Americans is that they're innately, almost like a genetic feature, they are left hemisphere. They don't know how to implement it anymore, but they are basically, that's our fundamentalism, is left hemisphere. And so the left hemisphere approach to right hemisphere environment being rock and roll, is easily supplied by males. You follow that?
Okay, yeah.
Now, there are lots of female writers, but you're saying that sure. the male writer seems to make a bigger impact.
The field is dominated by I mean it's less so now than it used to be, obviously. Just like I mean pop music itself is less dominated by male. I mean, well, it's always been a mix of male and female in the music itself, but you know, in terms of kind of who dominates the discussion, I mean, you know, if you think of pop music in the 60s and certainly the 50s, yeah, there were a lot of female singers, but there weren't a lot of self sort of formed female bands and that sort of stuff, and that was really kind of more like an outgrowth of punk and all that sort of stuff. So similar kind of shift in gender has probably erupted in the writing, but the field still seems the sort of geekier aspects of the field certainly seem to be dominated by the men.
Yeah, geek. That's a left hemisphere trying to prop up the eye in an ear tactile environment. That's what a nerd geek is. Now, I'll give you an example of the relevance of Lewis. Lewis, you know, had lots of friends who were artists. And there's a story that he would go over and look at a friend's painting, you know, go into the guy's studio, and he would stand there with his feet solidly planted in front of the painting and stare at it for a long time. Then remove himself from looking at the painting and leave the studio without making any comment. And people ask him, why don't you ever comment? And he says, a nonverbal art does not require a verbal response. You know what I mean? It's his eye is looking at an eye expression, the painting, and he's only going to have an eye response, no verbal response. So he was trying to keep the art separate. He knew the modalities, understood the implosion and the tactile effect that was happening, but he said, no, the eye must remain solid. He's a fanatic of the eye, a fundamentalist of the eye. And so he broke up the senses that were emerging under electric conditions, where Joyce obviously took the other mode. He imploded them, creating the stream of consciousness of Ulysses and then the more fantastic style of Finnegan's Wake, where there's not one word readable. He implodes all the senses. So Wyndham Lewis is giving an eye response. Now, he's representing traditional Western culture, an eyeball culture. And when the eyeball culture has to respond to the tactile electric environment of rock, that culture will want the eye to be represented. Look at that great line, maybe the greatest line in Finnegan's Wake, page 52 in the middle of the page. Television kills telephony and brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. So you'd have to take The writing about music is like dancing about architecture. No, writing about music is not dancing about architecture in a visual culture, in an alphabetized literary culture. Writing is is the only way the literary culture can approach music. So
Is the television kills telephony? Is that a precursor to video killed the radio star?
Yeah, as the deeper you get into Finnegan's Wake, there's not one idea since the book came out in 1939 that is not already in the wake. That's what the incredible thing is. So yeah, video killed the radio star is a replay, a quoting, unknowingly, of the patterns laid out in Finnegan's Wake. And the best translator of those patterns was McLuhan. And McLuhan, here's the interesting point, McLuhan learned how to look at the wake on a personal level, like who was his mentor? His mentor was Wyndham Lewis. He met him,
right,
talked to him, promoted him during the war in St. Louis.
Okay.
When McLuhan was teaching down there. You see how it's interesting. Who meets who is important. Who you get to know is probably predestined, or if you're going to be follow your path, your joy, it's the connections that are interesting. You know, who meets who and who does what.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's interesting about Meltzer, talking about knowing Patti Smith back in the early days, and then he and his buddies agreeing she turned into a problem.
Right. So what do you mean? Like, what's...
Well, Meltzer is an authority, and his writings are interesting because he met the people before they were known.
Right, right. And actually, an interesting... sort of flip there too is I guess before Patti Smith was really well known, I think it was back when she was maybe more known as a poet or something before she put out an album, there apparently her and Meltzer were both at some conference of rock critics in I think 1974 or something, and all the panelists were asked, you know, what's your definition of rock and roll, and I think Patti Smith actually stood up and said, whatever Richard Meltzer says, that's rock and roll. So she was like totally deferring to him. Because he kind of was the star at that time.
Yes. And do you know, have I ever told the story of my interaction with Patti Smith?
No.
See, if you read one of my interviews, I don't know which one it is, that was in Flipside, you'll see Jerry introduces it saying that I created, inspired punk rock.
Okay.
I don't want to go into that, but I was there at CBGB's in 75. And I was with Dean Latimer and the old East Village Other Gang that came out of Walter Bowert's scene. And I did not know Patti Smith, didn't know who she was, but I wanted to meet Dean at CBGB, so I don't think I was there in 1974. So it was April 75, and I think it was her famous week at CBGB's. Remember she was given a two-week run, and Dylan came, and that really sparked her?
Yeah, that sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know anything about that. So I'm just there, and this woman comes on and starts playing. And so obviously she's a poet, and it's a bit different take. So at the intermission, I went up to her, and I said, do you know Finnegan's Wake? And she says, yeah, I'm educated. I know it. I said, well, I think Finnegan's Wake is fitting into what you're doing. Of course, I already had that line. I said it to everybody. But I was working on duty back then. So I was planting the dogma then. And so she goes, okay, think about that. So when she came back out in the second set, she did some more songs and every now and then weaved in the phrase Finnegan's Wake or did a little take on it. She improvised it and fed it in. And then there's some subsequent encounters I had with her, but I won't go into them. But
okay.
it's interesting.
Incredible.
Yeah, that's it. In light of what I'm saying now, I did not know I'd be saying in this situation, and that Bangs had died, and Meltzer had been kicked out. I did not know all that in 75, but now it's all the effects preceding the causes. It's all prophetic. And I just finished reading Meltzer's complaint about Patti Smith, you know, an hour ago.
Okay, cool.
In your interview with Meltzer.
Right, okay. Let's actually go into a little bit of the... Actually, I don't want to go into the Meltzer stuff first. I want to throw a couple of the Lester Bangs quotes at you, actually. So, from the Lester Bangs Kraftwerk piece that I sent you...
Okay, let me just get it. I'll move forward here.
Sure.
I've got the pile of articles.
Sure.
It was really great to read these again.
Now, I may not have all the pages here, because I've kind of copied and pasted some of these into my notes, but...
Yeah, here it is. A Kraftwerk feature...
That's correct.
Yeah.
So he's talking to the, I can't remember what this quote is, but here's the quote. He's saying,
which page is it?
The member of, see, I don't know what page it is, because I've copied and pasted some of the notes.
Okay.
But one of the band members says to Bangs, I think, anything a hand can do, a machine can do better. And then Bangs says, an addendum would seem to be that anything a hand can do nervously, a machine can do effortlessly. So is that like a misunderstanding of McLuhan's idea that technologies are extensions of our beings?
No, it's not bad. That's what was interesting about reading Bangs and these guys and Meltzer or anybody on the scene. I mean, I remember the first Rolling Stone little article on David Bowie, you know, when he had long hair and just came over, it might have been about 1970, came over to the States. You might want to look this up, and I appreciate you sending me that article on McLuhan at the San Francisco College in Rolling Stone.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because I have that, but that's a great article, and it's just nice to have it in email form. Okay, so around, that's about 1970, that article, so around that time, here's David Bowie being quoted, and me being the McLuhan potential archivist, knowing McLuhan should be talked a lot more than was, here's this little kid going, wow, I'm really interested in McLuhan. Did you know that David Bowie said that?
No idea.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to go back and go through, you know, remember he had long hair when he first came over, before he was 71?
Absolutely, yeah, before he was, it was more like an androgynous thing rather than the full-out glam sort of phase or whatever.
Yeah, it's almost like he's a folk singer or something.
Folky almost, yeah.
Yeah, if you can go and find a Rolling Stone article, I'm pretty sure it was Rolling Stone, find that, it's a good quote to find in the microfilm. So, the point is that's why one would follow the young intellectuals. The McLuhan had made it, they all knew a bit about McLuhan, you know, distorted. But
I was going to say, McLuhan was kind of very, like, quoted by a lot of people then, too.
Yeah.
Like, he was like a pop cult sort of figure at that point.
He was like Ulysses. Not everybody read Ulysses in the 20s, but
right,
they knew
right.
It was important. They knew they had to say it was important. That's what McLuhan was. I mean, he made a big impact, so they had to respond to that. And,
right.
Of course, there were so much information back then, overload, that McLuhan got lost in the flood pretty quickly. But it was always interesting to see McLuhan pop up in a conversation by Bangs or Bowie quoting him. So, well, now what was I going to say about this? That's why I would read Bangs and them to see when they would get to the nub of the matter, and that's what's good about this particular article, because they bring up this point about what is an extension and what isn't. This is obviously a derivative of McLuhan, but the thing is that this came all from Finney's Wake, and that's what Kraftwerk and Bangs don't know. They don't know that part.
Okay, so
is the extension, is the machine more important than the handcraft? Now, McLuhan would say, and he said it many times in the 50s, 60s, that the machine became an art form in the 20s, with the constructivists and Joyce, Pound, and the Vorticists and Lewis, they turned the hardware machine, into an art form because there was a new environment, the software environment, which was kind of invisible, but was making people see the older environment, which was the machine. And so to say the machine is better than the hand is a position stated in the 20s by different artistic schools, okay? And then there's the reaction to that, you know. People, I don't believe that, and they go back to pre-Raphaelitism or medievalism or surrealism. They react to it. But here's the interesting thing, is that Kraftwerk is saying this, and Lester Bangs is thinking about and arguing with it. They're both what I call extensions of the Android meme, which is a replay of everything up to 1945. So they don't even know, Bangs and Kraftwerk, that they're arguing McLuhan, and they don't know that that argument is an old argument. And resolved as well as a human could do with Finnegan's Wake. See, it would have been fantastic if I was at these interesting points to come in. And when I did talk to Bangs, I bring this stuff, but they weren't. They didn't know what I was talking about, you know? They didn't know. It's interesting. Here's Bangs sort of doing McLuhan line. He might not even know it. Maybe in retrospect, he'd know it. But if I came in and said, this is a McLuhan doll, he'd say, no, McLuhan has nothing to do with this. Bangs might say that. They didn't recognize, and it's so important, and we'll get to it. What Meltzer says about McLuhan is absolutely absurd.
No, I think I know where you're going with that, and I've often thought that. It's like, yeah, I mean, he's even got a couple of McLuhan references in The Aesthetics of Rock,
yes,
where he disses him.
Yeah, they don't get it that he's doing that. He's trying to get to McLuhan's understanding of rock.
Yeah, although he does say in his introduction, I know we're getting a bit off, but he says in his introduction, you know, after he got kicked out of Yale and stuff and he cried, he said, you know, I'll never be the McLuhan of rock. That's what he was thinking at the time, kind of thing. So he obviously, like, had it on his mind. And
everybody, any smart kid back then, because, look, that's in 1965, 66 when he gets kicked out of Yale. That's when McLuhan is really strong. He's new, and people are listening to him. By 68, 69, which is, according to McLuhan, 600 years later, because we live 200 years every 12 months in the 60s. So 600 years later, by 68, 69, you're going to be dissing McLuhan. He's old ass. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is an effect of the electric environment that one should be aware of, that things will age right in front of your eyes because the tactile environment turns it over so quickly. You should try to figure out how you're being seduced by that and not go with the flow and be melted away and actually unconsciously tune into the new effect and think, oh yeah, McLuhan's old hat and Bucky Fuller is where it's at or something like that. You get swept along and put through changes and you're not fully aware of it. And that's what we're leading towards. This is what Kruskal and them should be teaching, which is, you know, obviously a silly word to be applied to them, but we're doing that. I am the Meltzer of our time. I am Alyssa Bangs pronging you guys, complaining like Bangs and Meltzer did, that you guys aren't paying attention to the real meaning of rock. But it's certainly a different meaning in the way we talk about today, because rock is long gone, disappeared. It's over, you know. But not for the young kids. They're the little, as McLuhan said in the 60s, young people are vegetables. You let them grow and evolve, and they might get to a human level. He said that about kids in the 60s. So I'm saying rock critics are like vegetables. We have to put up with their nonsense digressions over decades as they grow and evolve into approximating a tactile perception and becoming a fully fledged cell.
But they're making some perceptions there too.
But they all crack up. I'm going to explain why they crack up. Why did Meltzer freak out?
Well, yeah, but Meltzer is a very sort of specific case in that regard. I mean, you know,
Grail Marcus. Robert, here's the thing,
Grail Marcus. I mean, someone like Grail Marcus. I mean, that's another tangent. But I mean, he's probably kept himself kind of interested in going as a music critic because he doesn't just write about music.
No, they're machines. Kruskal and Marcus are machines. Meltzer is a nostalgic nature lover. He wants to get back to the chemical body. He's a romantic. And he says, you guys accepted being a machine, which then ties back into this statement between Kraftwerk and Banks.
Okay.
Can't remember. Remember, Andy Warhol says, I want to be a machine. He says that in the middle 60s.
Right.
Okay, but to say, McLuhan said, I want to be global programmer of the computer thermostat, way beyond just being a machine. I'm going to include fascism, communism, capitalism, and free enterprise, and anarchism all within my program. I'm not just going to be a machine. I'm going to be able to mold the machine, orchestrate it with the software machine. And that we'll get into later, because I could say all this stuff and go all the way to the end, but it's no point. We're going to gradually replay, come back, and move forward. When Meltzer is impressed with McLuhan's review of Naked Lunch, boy, have I got a lot to say about that. His interpretation is immature and silly and uninformed. But here's what I wanted to... Okay. Oh, yeah. I was with Marcus in L.A. one time, and he was giving a performance, talking, reviewing something. I gave a lecture. And so in the question period, I brought up Finnegan's Wake, and as I always do. I'm always on point. You remember what, you know the story of Zappa when he goes through German customs and Fritz, the customs guy, assumes Zappa's on drugs?
No, I don't know.
And he says to Frank, okay, Frank, what are you on? You know, what drug are you having there and you're going to have to give to me before you go through customs? Frank says, I'm on duty.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. You have said that before.
Yeah, it's a great line. Well, I'm on duty. I come across Grail Marcus in the 90s. So I bring up Finnegan's Wake, and Grail Marcus, I mean, he's a professor at Yale or Harvard or something, right?
Yeah, I don't know specific. I think he's done a lot of different professorships.
Yeah, okay. So he's a literate guy. I bring up Phoenix Wake, and he says, "Whoa, that's way over my head. You can't bring up that. That's not relevant to this discussion." Bing, bang. What is it? Okay, get rid of him, Marcus. He fucked up. You know, he doesn't even know. See, they have naive, literate views of what the Wake is. They think it's elitist art. It isn't. It's rock and roll.
But what if the ideas that they're writing are still like relevant ideas, even if they, as you say, come from the Finnegan's Wake? Like, what?
No.
They're still imparting some of those ideas, even if they're saying they don't like. Is there no value in that?
Okay, this is the cry of the literate kid. But we just
heard.
Value in the thinking, Bob.
I know.
But this is perfect. Now we can go into rock and roll's is Phoenix Wake in print, or vice versa. But there is no content ultimately in Phoenix Wake. There's no possibility of an idea to have any staying power in the tactile environment. And for literate people to not be able to maintain a point of view, that is hell. And so when you're frustrated by that electronic Niagara Falls of information, you can't hold on any point of view. You need a release. So you retrieve the ear, and you retrieve a loud ear. And rock and roll was loud in the 50s, and get louder in the 60s, and louder in the 70s, and multi-leveled in the 80s with MTV. This stimulus, this balancing of the void that electric environment creates in the literate mind, the left hemisphere, rock and roll serves an anesthetic, medicinal purpose there. And so you see Meltzer racing along, just celebrating the medicine he's taking, all the bands of the mid-60s. And I love he's really good at citing the good stuff. And I want to say, whoever wrote the article, it might have been O'Brien,
right?
He runs through the autobiography of his ears, not of him, of his ears, of his virtual ears.
Yeah, I like that, Jeffrey O'Brien, yeah.
Yeah, he ends with Hello Stranger, Barbara Lewis. Bingo! That's the greatest, one of the greatest songs of all history.
I
think it's Hello Stranger he names. He names something by her, but just saying Barbara Lewis is perfect. And you know, it's really interesting. Yeah. You can go on Google or on YouTube and look at some Pat Boone guy, you know, Bobby Darin replays all the greatest clips of Hullabaloo or Dick Clark. And you can, there's one of, they just go like 5 seconds each group, right, as they go through the hits of the 60s. And there's a little shot of Barbara Lewis, and I love that. I never saw what she looked like. And,
wow.
And there she is. She's a little chubby woman. But now, I'm talking about the ecstasy. McLuhan in the 60s talked about we're in the era of millennial or millenary, either word, millennial ecstatics. This is, you see, Meltzer's, he tries to throw in the philosophical categories and immediately cancels them, knowing it's irrelevant. He's trying to be right hemisphere. He's celebrating the ecstasy that this stuff puts him into, but he doesn't recognize that it's going to drive him headlong crash into an identity crisis, hit the wall, when somehow he wakes up to that process. And that happened, I guess, 68, 69. The music changed its timbre, its pitch, and he didn't like it. So he stopped. All right?
Yeah.
And you sort of, to stay within the game, you got to say, okay, I got to change my ears. I got to start getting used to this stuff if I want to stay in it. Maybe I will get used to it. The thing is that it is a definite anesthetic medicine, rock and roll. You know, it's Viagra, it's Prozac, it's all that stuff. And then you can explain when we get into the digital era how the digital environment shrinks all the old analog media like rock music and all that. So people don't want music anymore. They just want a drug. They just want Prozac. Why be mediated? Just put me on a drug. So... So the millennial ecstatics, that electrics, you know, look at the Dobbs quadrant on my chart, you'll see that it's all ecstasy, whereas the Rouge quadrant is paranoia, McLuhan quadrant is schizophrenia, the Thompson quadrant is hysteria, and the Croker quadrant is panic. Now, those that don't know anything about my stuff, you just ignore what I said, but for those that do, you'll see the Dobbs quadrant is ecstasy. We've been stoned in electric ecstasy since about 1960, at least, you know, when television and became a mass environment. Everybody's been stoned, and now it's flipped into a digital fragmentation, and that's a different kind of ecstasy. It's actually, you could say the ecstasy of the 60s is a consumer's ecstasy. Now it's a producer ecstasy. People get on and make their own media, their own YouTubes. And even though there's no one watching, they get the ecstasy of producing it. Hey, look what I made.
Right.
You know? So, let's see. So we're talking about, is there any ideas? No. There's no ideas in rock. And here's Meltzer's dilemma. He's educated on the history of Western philosophy and art culture, and he has a McLuhanite as a mentor, Alan Kaprow, right?
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. He might have heard about McLuhan. He probably heard about McLuhan through Alan, you know, his mentor at college. McLuhan wrote about Kaprow around that time. It wasn't published until a few years later in the book Cliched Archetype. But anyway, so here he is trying to be, when he says philosophy, he's talking left hemisphere categories. And he is not embedded in a literate environment like his parents and grandparents were. He's grown up with radio and TV. He's not really on the surface a literate person. He is living in the electric effect. But when push comes to shove, it's like what he said in the mirror. I wish Meltzer would hear all this stuff someday, because I can remember the details. And Meltzer looks in the mirror at the time, what, he's 40? And he goes, yeah, I guess I'm a writer. Here he is getting older, and McLuhan predicted. He said in the 60s that the baby boomers, when they get into their 30s and 40s, they'll start reading a lot of books, because they will now have acquired a bit of literate identity, a bit of stronger individualist identity. They'll have a job, a role. They're not some kid running around trying to figure out how to be ecstatic all the time. They actually have responsibility, so they develop a left hemisphere solidity, and at that point they started appreciating books. So I mean, it's incredible if Meltzer heard this. Hey, McLuhan predicted your big insight at the age of 40, that you go, wow, I'm a left hemisphere person, I'm a writer. But the thing is, the stylistics ain't left hemisphere. It's derivative of Finnegan's Wake, and it's ranting. And so we come back to Meltzer ranting, celebrating the ecstasy, he's not even trying to be a writer in the 60s, in the mid-60s. He is just loves to write, and he says he's a visualist. Look at that. He's a Wyndham Lewis eye man. And he actually replays Lewis, because Meltzer, as Chris Gow said, was a social jerk, an asshole, and all that, right?
Right.
I never met Meltzer. I don't know if he is or not, but I can see a bit of it. He's probably a contrarian. Whatever's happening in a party, he'll start an intellectual fight, probably, or not even show up or leave. He's kind of rude. Well, that's the way Wyndham Lewis was. That's what an eye person is. Meltzer's an eye person. But you can't be an eye person. You know, when he says he's a visualist, he might as well say he's a painter, because you can't just be a black and white literate page eye person. You've got to be a visualist, like a painter, like more senses than just the black and white of the eye. Color is tactile. So he's a colorist, and he likes looking at spectacle stuff, like wrestling, and then do a painting of it. And that's exactly what Finnegan's Wake is. It's also a painting. He's not just being an alphabetic prose stylist or writer. He's spewing with a visual bias, and his personality matches that. He's an individualist. He's against. He actually doesn't know what he's for, but he's against the conformity that he perceived. Right?
Okay.
He's actually against the tribalism that ear represents, but he doesn't like commodified. Virtual tribalism, people consuming a product rather than going out and screwing somebody, or having sexual hedonism orgies, which is, sounds like what he's for, chemical body ecstatic releases. He doesn't like the usurping of that by the virtual reality of televised music, and how he objects to how that's taking us over. We cannot stop it. There's no chemical body meaning and purpose in it. It's just for your virtual ears and eyes and virtual tactility. You're a consumer in the discarded state. And that's the robotness, the cyborg aspects of Marcus and Crisco and the regular professional critic that he objects to.
Right.